From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Prince, his life and music. We talk with Dan Pipenbring, who Prince chose to work with him on his autobiography. Just a few months after they started working together, Prince died. Pipenbring edited a new book called The Beautiful Ones that includes the pages Prince had written about his childhood, adolescence, and sexual awakening. Pipenbring learned that one of Prince's earliest musical memories was sitting on the piano bench next to his father.
Prince learning the Batman theme song. He was very into Adam West's Batman. He'd sit there playing, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, Batman, and the rest is history, you know.
Also,
I am Mr. Robot.
We hear from the creator of the TV series Mr. Robot, Sam Esmail. It stars Rami Malek as a hacker who breaks into the network of a giant corporation that he considers evil. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Before Prince died, he'd started writing a memoir. He wanted a writing partner he could open up to. After rejecting several high-profile names, he settled on my guest, Dan Pipenbring, who was definitely not famous. Pipenbring was a 29-year-old editor of the literary magazine Paris Review. Just a few months after their first meeting, Prince died of an opioid overdose on April 21, 2016. Prince had left behind the pages he'd already written about his childhood and adolescence in Minneapolis. Unable to complete the memoir, Pipenbring planned to write with Prince. Pipenbring fashioned the book into something else. It includes the chapters Prince had already written, as well as an essay by Pipenbring about working with Prince, Prince's handwritten lyrics to some of his songs, some photos of Prince, and images of things Pipenbring found in the vaults at Paisley Park, Prince's compound. The book, which is edited by Pipenbring, has the title Prince had planned to give his memoir, The Beautiful Ones. It's named after the song Pipenbring describes as one of the most naked, aching songs in Prince's catalog. Let's start with that song. Dan Pipenbring, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
This book is great. I'm really glad that you were able to put out what you were able to put out posthumously. So you had written an essay explaining why you wanted to collaborate with Prince, and he critiqued your essay. And it's a really interesting critique. Like, you wrote that when you listened to Prince for the first time, you felt like you were breaking the law. And yes. The song you were listening to was If I Was Your Girlfriend. So
that's right.
Let's hear just a little bit of that, and then we'll talk about why you felt like you were breaking the law.
If I was your girlfriend, would you remember? You tell me all the things you forgot when I was your man. Hey, when I was your man. If I was your best friend, would you let me take care of you and do all the things that only a best friend can? Oh, only best friends can.
That was Prince singing his song, If I Was Your Girlfriend. My guest, Dan Pipenbring, is the editor of the new Prince memoir. So, Dan, why did that song, when you first heard it, the first time you heard Prince, why did it make you feel like you were breaking the law?
Yeah, I remember this vividly. I was, I think, 16 years old. I'd just gotten my driver's license. I was driving around alone for one of the first times ever, and that in itself is kind of an illicit feeling. And at the time, I was really listening to a lot of classic rock and jazz and things like that. And I was a drummer, so I really abhorred drum machines. I thought that they had no place in music. But then this song came on the radio. And in this song, Prince is singing under the persona that he called Camille. So he was speeding his voice up. In addition to singing in a falsetto, he had kind of sped the tape up so his voice sounded even more feminine and high-pitched. And then there's all these very ethereal synthesizers on there, and of course a drum machine playing this very eerie, spare backbeat. And Prince on that song is singing really from the perspective of a woman, but as a man who wants to be a woman so that he can be closer to his partner and get the access psychologically to her that he feels he's denied by virtue of his masculinity. I had just never heard anything so psychosexually frank, I don't think. It was really a haunting but beautiful song. It made me feel just sort of strange. I think combined with the fact that I was out there on the road by myself, it just seemed like something that was almost too intimate to be hearing.
When you wrote that you felt like you were breaking the law, Prince objected to that. He told you he objected to that at your first meeting. What was his objection?
He thought that his music was not at all law-breaking, that it was completely harmonious. And when he told me this, we were sitting across from each other in his conference room in kind of perfect silence, and we were surrounded by candles. And there was kind of a sense of harmony in the place. Paisley Park really felt like a sanctuary or a cocoon. I could see that I had offended him or misread him, and I worried that he'd flown me all the way out there just to say that. But to his mind, law-breaking music would be something more like Led Zeppelin or something, I guess, bluesier, more dissonant. And he felt that he was always trying to make music that was in accordance with the law, that had a harmony that elevated it to suit his more religious side, you know? So he really resisted the idea that he was in any way a lawbreaker.
Yeah, and he told you he writes in harmony and he always lives in harmony. An objection he raised about a lot of people who had written about him was their use of the word magical or alchemy to describe his music. Did you use either of those words in your essay?
Yes, yeah, I definitely use some variant of magical and maybe alchemy too, and also transfigure, which was a further word that he resisted.
Because
he had very, very particular fastidious ideas about which words belonged in his orbit, and particularly a word like transfigure, which of course has a very strong literal religious connotation, he felt that he could not apply that to his kind of secular music. It would be wrong. It would be a violation of the proper order of things. And magic, he had the most memorable objection to. He said that Funk is the opposite of magic. Funk is about rules. And he pointed to all the work that went into his music, that there was really no magic in it. It was a labor of love, but a labor nonetheless, and that he'd had to learn to play all of these 27 instruments that he played on his first album, that he'd had to learn how to mix them, how to master them, how to program the drum machine, and that funk was about rules. And I would come to see, once I learned about his parents, that that kind of discipline side really came a lot from his father.
He also thought that, you know, magic or magical, those were Michael words, not Prince words.
That's right. He said when he was driving me back to the hotel in his car, he looked over and said, you know, really think carefully about which words you would use, because magical is not one that I would use to describe me. That is Michael's word. He thought that Michael Jackson's music had this kind of magic. And I think he's right about that. If you listen to something on Thriller, there is a kind of storybook quality to it, a more fairy tale vibe, something magical that doesn't quite show up that much in Prince's own catalog.
One of the reasons why Prince wanted to write a memoir was that he wanted to explain how he emerged as a synthesis of his parents. What are some of the ways his parents were different from each other?
In the memoir pages that he sat me down and showed me in Australia, from the very first paragraph, he's thinking about his mother and father and how they really formed the kind of two poles of his being. And he said in my last conversation with him 4 days before he died that that was really one of the central dilemmas of his life. He said that he liked order, finality, and truth. Those were all things that he ascribed to his father. But if a DJ put on something funky, he was going to want to dance, and that would be his mother's influence. His mother in these pages emerges as a very free-spirited, almost headstrong woman, someone who was irrepressibly free, I think, and who would not allow herself to be told what to do or how to do it. And of course, we see that time and again in Prince's career. But his father was a much more disciplined, religious man, someone who worked two jobs, one as a musician at nightclubs and the other at the Honeywell factory in Minneapolis. And he really was, he was concerned with just getting food on the table and keeping the trains running on time. And you see that in Prince too. I mean, that vast work ethic, that commitment to making things happen. So I think to his mind, he was always trying to reconcile the way that those two came together in him, and I think he felt the tension there a lot, and that's something that he would explore throughout his career.
And it's something he kind of explores in his song When Doves Cry, and he was hoping that he could break down the lyrics in the book. He didn't live long enough to do that. But what did he tell you about the lyric to When Doves Cry?
Well, there's a great passage in the memoir pages where he's written down the margin vertically, When Doves Cry, and that is the section of the book pertaining to his parents' divorce, which was a word that they were reluctant even to use with him. They would say, you know, I'm going to go away for a while. You might not see so much of me. So I think the true scope of their strife or of their struggle to kind of make their relationship work was something that he felt was kind of hidden from him, and that was what he was trying to get at in When Doves Cry. Like, why did this thing fall apart? Why was there physical violence between his mother and his father? At one point, his mother even used him sort of as a human shield. She said, go tell your father that he has to be nice to me. And I think all of those memories came flooding back really unbidden at so many times in his life, that when he sat down to write When Doves Cry, he was really trying to figure out how he embodied them and how he could unify himself in the way that they were not able to unify their love.
Do you want to quote the lines that specifically refer to a mother and a father in When Doves Cry?
That's right. How can you just leave me standing alone in the world so cold? Maybe I'm just too demanding. Maybe I'm just like my father, too bold. Maybe I'm just like my mother, she's never satisfied. And it's interesting because I would have thought that his mother was just as bold as his father, given the way she's depicted in his memoir pages. But I can see what he means about her never being satisfied. She always wanted more, and he writes that she always wanted a sort of whirlwind love affair involving a lot of travel and gifts and kind of active romance. And his father, in his boldness, I think, was just lashing out at that. You know, he was too much concerned with the more quotidian day-to-day stuff to indulge that romantic side.
Well, let's hear When Doves Cry. That, of course, is Prince, When Doves Cry. How did he start playing music?
It was through his father. They would sit together at the piano, and I remember Prince learning the Batman theme song. He was very into Adam West's Batman. So he'd sit there playing, you know, Batman, and the rest is history, you know. It's a short leap from there to Purple Rain.
You know, it's interesting. Like, his name is Prince. What was his given name? It's not like a name he took on for himself. But in school, in elementary school, teachers wouldn't call him Prince, or at least one of his teachers wouldn't call him Prince. Like, explain why not.
I think that they felt that there was just something wrong about it. He compared it to a boy having the name King and how a teacher would never want to call anyone King. I think to conjure royalty in the classroom would make a teacher, an authority figure, kind of unsettled. Here is this child who is clearly not supposed to be in control, not supposed to be the authority, but to use a word like prince, it summons that very level of authority. So they would call him Skipper instead. And I think Prince, of course, has various challenges to authority that he raises in his music throughout his career. And I think it all goes back to those experiences in the classroom where he felt that he had this name. It was his name. It was his father's name. It was something that he held very closely, and yet it had no place in school for some reason. I can imagine how that must have frustrated him.
And yet during part of his career, he abandoned his name and became the artist formerly known as Prince.
That's right. I think that only indicates, again, how almost sacred the name was to him, especially because of the bond that it forged between him and his father, you know, being one of two princes in that household. And in the 90s, when he was quarreling with Warner Brothers, his record label, I think he felt that if he was not able to control his creative output and to live the way he wanted to live, then he couldn't, in good faith, live under his given name. He had to kind of forsake it.
Your last conversation with Prince was a phone call 4 days before he died. This was on April 17th, 2016. Tell us about the phone call.
It was the only time he had called my cell phone, and my cell phone was charging at the time, and I had a very short cord, so I had to kind of stoop on the floor and talk to him. And I remember scrawling everything he said on a stray piece of paper I had. And he just wanted to call to tell me that he was okay. This was toward the end when his plane had had to make an emergency landing. He had just made what would turn out to be his last public appearance. And I think there was a lot of speculation in the press that something might be wrong. And he told me, no, I just wanted to say that I'm all right. And then immediately he returned to the theme of his parents and addressed that central dilemma, as he called it. He also wanted to talk about the idea of cellular memory, this idea that maybe in his cells, his literal body, in his genes, he had inherited the memories and traumas of his parents. And I think he found that something that really aligned with his religious views and with the feelings he'd been kind of carrying around for his whole life about the way his mom and his dad lived inside him.
You had heard in the press that Prince's plane was made an emergency landing because Prince had a bad case of the flu, and you told him mm-hmm. that you were sorry he had the flu and hoping he felt better. And he said, no, flu-like symptoms. What was he trying to tell you, do you think, when he said flu-like symptoms?
Yeah, I've pored over those words so many times since then, and I do have to wonder, he didn't want to lie to me, clearly, but I think he just wanted to signal that while he felt that he was fine and on the mend, that there was, something wrong. And I think it was really just a desire not to tell a lie and to say that, yes, he was feeling bad, but that he couldn't really put his finger on what it was, maybe.
So he died 4 days after that call of an overdose of fentanyl. When you were working with him, what did you know about his use of opioids?
Absolutely nothing. I saw no evidence of it ever. And I was just gobsmacked when that news came out because it did not square at all with the man I had met, who was so sunny and who would sometimes be literally bouncing on the balls of his feet. I remember once we were in that elevator at Paisley, the same one where he would later be found, and he was just, he said, you've got me all hopped up on this industry talk. I can't wait to write about the music industry and my mother. And to think that in that same space he would later be found dead, it's just something that I could not imagine. So I never had any idea. He was so vivacious and put so much care into everything he said and did that I had no inkling of what he was up against.
Dan Pipenbring, it's been really a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. It's been so great to be here.
And the new Prince book, edited by Dan Pipenbring, is called Prince, The Beautiful Ones. My next guest is Sam Esmail. He's the creator and lead writer and director of the TV series Mr. Robot, which is in its fourth and final season on USA Network. Mr. Robot stars Rami Malek as a hacker who's tried to withdraw from the world while at the same time is trying to control it through his ability to hack into a giant corporate computer network. There's a blurry line between his attempts to be a force for good and his attempts to just burn the system down. Shadowy networks he's up against have made it hard for him to tell if he's the one in control or if he's being manipulated. He also doesn't know what's real and what's a figment of his imagination, and neither do we, because he has dissociative identity disorder, DID, a mental health diagnosis previously known as multiple personality disorder. Director Sam Esmail is pretty knowledgeable about computer networks and hacking. In college, he was put on academic probation because of hacking. When he was 20, back in the dial-up era, before broadband, he created a startup designed to give easier dial-up access to the internet. But his real ambition was always to make movies. Let's start with the opening scene of season one of Mr. Robot. Elliot, Rami Malek's character, is a hacker who, at this point in the story, also works as a cybersecurity expert. He's just walked into a cafe called Ron's and has sat down at a table opposite the owner.
You're Ron. But your real name's Rohit Mehta. You changed it to Ron when you bought your first Ron's coffee shop 6 years ago. Now you got 17 of them, with 8 more coming next quarter.
May I help you with something?
I like coming here because your Wi-Fi was fast. I mean, you're one of the few spots that has a fiber connection with gigabit speed. It's good. It's so good, it scratched that part of my mind, part that doesn't allow good to exist without condition. So I started intercepting all the traffic on your network. That's when I noticed something strange. That's when I decided to hack you. I know you run a website called Plato's Boys.
Pardon me?
You're using Tor networking to keep the servers anonymous. You made it really hard for anyone to see it. But I saw it. The onion rooting protocol, it's not as anonymous as you think it is. Whoever's in control of the exit nodes is also in control of the traffic, which makes me the one in control.
I must ask you to kindly leave.
I own everything. All your emails, all your files, all your pics.
Get out of here right now, or I'll call the
police. You want them to find out about the 100 terabytes of child pornography you served to your 400,000 users? Personally, man, I was hoping it was just gonna be some BDSM stuff. You realize how much simpler that would have been?
I did not hurt anyone. I never did. That's my personal life.
I understand what it's like to be different. I'm very different, too. I don't know how to talk to people. My dad was the only one I could talk to. But he died.
Sam Esmail, welcome to Fresh Air. That is one of the great opening scenes in TV history.
It's
really so good. And, you know, it's funny because so much of what we hear in that scene comes in one way or another from your life. I mean, it's not autobiographical, but you can draw on what you know from it. I mean, so you did some hacking when you were in college. You edited porn, so you know something about the porn world when you were scratching around right. for a living. You know about being different because you grew up Egyptian, American, and Muslim in New Jersey. So, like so many of the talking points in that opening scene, I'm sure you could relate to, but you took what you know and then you drove it to a totally different place that I really think you did not know.
Yes, for sure. Honestly, it's that outsider mentality is what I think the Elliot character and my life sort of overlap, and it has a lot to do with growing up in an Egyptian-American household while trying to assimilate into American culture, and that sort of tension, you know, because not only was I born in Jersey, then my parents took me down to South Carolina, which was somewhat cruel for an Egyptian to be raised in, and then North Carolina. And I've always kind of constantly had to deal with this concept of this idea of being very different than the others.
Part of what we heard the Elliot character say, Rami Malek's character say in that opening scene, with the fantastic Wi-Fi at this coffee shop, he says, it scratched the part of my mind that doesn't allow good to exist without condition, which is a beautiful way of saying too good to be true. I really like the words you chose to describe that. But does that describe you, that you're always thinking, this is too good to be true, that your mind doesn't allow good to exist without condition?
I think that, I mean, you know, I suffered a lot from social anxiety disorder. I still work through that even now. I had a deep fear of the world around me, and I think that's part of the journey we wanted to tell about Elliot. Honestly, that, again, something that we drew from hacker culture, there's a lot of paranoia, not only paranoia, but it kind of beyond that, just a lot of distrust in what's going on around us. And I think that's where that line came from, is that can we fully allow ourselves to feel good about something without feeling like the other shoe is going to drop? And I think that's a constant anxiety that's just prevalent around in society right now.
For the character of Elliot, the social anxiety and the dissociative identity disorder go hand in hand with him being a hacker, because really the only way he can connect with people is through technology, and the only way he can learn about who people are is through hacking them. For you, did social anxiety issues connect with your I don't want to say obsession. I don't know how, if you were obsessed or not, but connect with how involved you were with technology when you were in college. I mean, you created a startup. You worked in the computer lab. You did some hacking.
Yes. The short answer is yes. You know, I had social anxiety, which meant I did not want to go out a lot because I was afraid to go out. I was afraid to go to parties. I was afraid of embarrassing myself. So I stayed in my dorm room or I went to the computer lab. And instead, I tried to talk to people online. It felt safer. And when you are in that position where you're just behind a computer and essentially replacing a social life with that. So then when you're behind that computer and you have the sort of wherewithal to sort of pick up and try and learn how to get into people's email accounts or people's social media accounts. When I was in college, it was specifically email accounts. Then that becomes your form of socializing with people. I think that's honestly the kind of more common route that hackers find themselves in, or it's sort of the way hackers sort of, at least in my experience, the hackers that I knew growing up, that's how they started going down that road, is that finding that replacement of connection with people.
And was that true for you, like in your limited career as a hacker? did you feel like you were replacing intimacy with hacking people's emails?
Oh yeah. And I think I've spoken about this, and I'm not exactly proud about this, but I definitely hacked my girlfriend, at the time we were sort of off and on again, off again, back in college, and then I hacked her college and sent out this email, and I was talking, I was trying to essentially show off to her, and I sent out this blast email to the entire campus of her college, and then got busted. And again, I'm not a very good hacker. I got busted pretty easily because I worked at the computer lab at NYU, and they essentially traced it back to the employee's computer at the lab. And it was time stamped. So it was at the time when I was working there, and so they found out. They caught me pretty easily, and I got fired and put on probation. So that was the time when I was like, okay, well, I'm going to give up on this hacking pursuit. It's just not for me.
Until you were caught, did it feel good to hack your girlfriend and her college? Or did it feel like you were violating her?
I want to be honest, right? Because I think I should say, no, it felt terrible and I shouldn't do this, but in the moment it felt like the only way to know the truth. I guess that's the only way I can say it, is that I wanted to know how she actually felt about me, because I didn't trust if what she was telling me was true. And so I wanted to know if she really liked me. I thought maybe she didn't, or maybe she liked somebody else, or, and there, I don't know. I had probably had 20 theories back then about what it was that we weren't connecting on.
And did you find out what you wanted to know?
No. I think we weren't right for each other. I mean, I think that's the answer, right? I think I was not in a very healthy place with my social anxiety. It was way worse than it is today. I wasn't coping with it at all. I was indulging it. I was probably getting worse. And I think it was probably very difficult to be in any kind of relationship with me, not just romantic friendship or, any sort of one-on-one connection, because I had this real deep insecurity and deep fear of other people.
And now, I mean, like, you're a director. You have to not only connect with people, you have to give them advice about what the emotions are that their character is experiencing. You have to hold everything together and make sure that relationships are good on the set. They're hopefully good on the set. So how do you deal with your social anxiety in your job as director?
Well, I think my wife really if it wasn't for my wife, I don't know if I would be able to handle my social anxiety as adequately, I will say, as I do right now, which is to say that, you know, on set, though, I will, you know, to me, the work is the work, right? I'm there to make, to tell the story as best I can. And I don't really have those same fears as if I'm at a party where the whole point, the whole purpose is to socialize and to chit chat and to share, you know, share, open up about your private life and to ask people about their private life. And that's where my wife really, really was able to hold my hand. You know, I couldn't even go to any of the award shows that first year with Mr. Robot without her being there, holding my hand the entire time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sam Esmail. He's the creator and lead director and writer of the TV series Mr. Robot, which is in its fourth and final season on USA Network. A heads up to parents, the next chapter includes a section that might not be suitable for young children. We'll be talking, not explicitly, about his first film job, which was editing porn. I think your first job working in film was editing porn. And is that your first?
Yep.
Okay.
That would be my first.
So we got to talk about it.
Yeah. Let's do it.
So first of all, I mean, your parents are Egyptian and Muslim. So did they know that you were editing porn?
No. And I mean, honestly, they didn't know much. I didn't tell them. I got away with a lot because they were sort of closed off to American culture and they weren't honestly that interested in my life. I mean, I wanted to be a filmmaker since I was eight. They kept being, I told them that, but they were sort of in denial about that for a long time. And to the point where when I went to NYU, I just lied and told them I was going to, because they weren't going to pay for it if I went to film, if I said I was going to go to film school. So I just told them I was in computer programming. So I kept a lot of my sort of ambition into filmmaking, that's a secret from them. And in fact, even now, my mom kind of knows I have a TV show, but it's such a vague concept to her. She doesn't watch the show. I don't think she really sort of, you know, wraps her mind around it.
Okay. So when you were editing porn, did you get turned on while you were editing?
No.
No.
No, I got turned off. I mean, you know, it's a lot of close-ups of human anatomy and not necessarily, like, you know, the most hygienic human human anatomy shots, and you know, it's a lot, and it's a lot of, you get to see a lot of, like, the mechanics of it in terms of, you know, okay, stop, now do this, and, you know, and there's a pause. I don't know how graphic you want to get, but, like, there's a lot of pauses of, you know, people needing to a refresher to get back into the mood. There's a lot of that going on. It's not a turn on at all. It's the opposite, I would say.
You probably can't describe it. I'm really wondering what the outtakes were like.
I mean, again, it's a lot of soft penises. If you want me to be honest, it's a lot of guys freaking out and having to, because, you know, the porn that I was editing was you know, a lot of amateur porn. So it wasn't like big porn stars. So it was a lot of guys doing it for the first or second or third time. And, you know, they would freak out. And a lot of times, you know, because I was also on the shoots too sometimes. And a lot of times we would have to cancel it because it wasn't going to happen, you know?
So how did you make a salary editing amateur porn? Because I would assume amateur porn is edited by the amateurs.
Oh, no, no, no. I mean, well, when I say amateur porn, I mean that they're not necessarily porn stars.
I see.
Still, the production's still, like, you know,
like amateur B films.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, yes, the Roger Corman of porn. Yeah, that, I mean, honestly, that it was, it still paid extremely well. Given, mm-hmm. I mean, at least, you know, being 26 and just having graduated film school, it paid my rent and then some. So I was kind of necessarily happy to do it, but for me, because editing was, you know, came easy and it was on a computer and I kind of understood tech really well and I could figure out how to use Final Cut pretty easily, it it was pretty easy for me, easy money for me.
And are we talking about the internet porn era, or is this still for theaters?
No, this was internet porn for sure, yeah.
Okay, so titles. There are some great porn titles that are puns or plays on the titles of real movies or TV shows. Do you have any favorites?
No, the ones that I made were spinoffs of reality shows, because reality shows had started to get really popular, and so what porn did was kind of jump on that. So I think the porn that I ended up editing a lot of was this one called Blind Sex Dates, because at the time there was a show called, I believe it was just called Blind Dates, and it was a reality show. It was obviously super fake, but it was a reality show where two people were on a blind date and they followed them around. And so the spin on this was, like, you know, they were on a date for 2 minutes in the episode, and then they went home and had sex for, you know, 45 minutes, and that was the Blind Sex Dates show. So that was the one that I worked on the most.
So you grew up mostly in New Jersey, briefly lived in South Carolina. Your parents immigrated to the U.S. from Egypt. They're Muslim. Were you bullied or feeling left out because you were different when you were growing up in Jersey and South Carolina?
Oh, constantly. I remember when I was five, I think I was called sand nigger so much that I didn't even know that was a pejorative until I think I said it out loud in front of adults. My parents didn't even know. So I'd say in front of my parents, they wouldn't even know. I got beat up. I remember the first day of kindergarten at my older sister, Nancy. She was born mentally challenged. And so she would get picked on a lot. And therefore, I would get sort of residual bullying from that. And they were picking on her, I remember, on the first day of kindergarten at the bus stop. And so, I tried to stand up for her. And then I just got beat up by, you know, about five kids from the neighborhood. One of them actually ended up being one of my good friends, ironically enough, after that. But I probably got into more fights than I can remember all through elementary school and middle school.
You know, you mentioned you have a sister who's mentally challenged, and I'm wondering if that figured into your decision to create the Rami Malek character in Mr. Robot as somebody who's cognitively different.
I think so. I think it ultimately it's more about being different. I think it's more about that. And it's cumulative, right? It's a piece of that. It's a piece of just maybe being just not able to easily fit in with other people and being socially awkward. And it's a lot of it had to do with being Egyptian and just being different. You know, my real name isn't Sam, and I changed it into Sam when I was eight because that's how much I got bullied about it and made fun of at school.
I ask you what your name was?
I don't actually tell people.
Oh, that's fine.
Sorry,
yeah, that's fine. You know, I respect that.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, that's how traumatizing I think it was for me growing up. So it's really about that. It was really about the fact that I was sort of pushed to this cast aside a lot. And I think it was all cumulative. I think it was all the kind of being different, not being able to connect with other people, and all of those things, all the details, my sister, my parents, and the way I grew up in South Carolina, all of that kind of fed into who Elliot became.
You loved movies. Did not seeing yourself represented in movies make you feel left out or distanced from what you loved?
No, it did the opposite. I thought I was not normal, and the people in the movies were, and it just made me aspire to be them. So the reason I think my avenue, the reason why I loved movies so much is that I could escape into that world and pretend I am those people that were normal, people that were more accepted, good-looking people who were connected with other good-looking people and who were powerful and successful and charismatic and could talk to each other. And it wasn't until later when I started watching Kubrick films that I realized, oh, you could actually talk about outsiders too. You could actually channel the person that I knew I was deep down as well. And that's when I started to kind of realize the power of what, in terms of like what I could bring to it as a storyteller and how I can bring my experiences to the storytelling. Because initially it was just all about escapism, and then it became about something channeling something, something more real inside me.
Was it frustrating for you that your parents didn't like movies? They didn't care about movies. I don't know if they liked them or not, but they didn't care. They didn't go. You didn't go with them. So that was like something you were obsessed with was something you couldn't really share with them.
It was incredibly frustrating. I mean, that doesn't even, you got to remember, they didn't care about anything related to American culture. So yeah, movies, they would drop me off at noon. At the movie theater, I'd buy one ticket, and then I would stay until 10 p.m., and I would theater hop and sneak into other movies.
Oh, at the Multiplex?
I would see four movies, and then they'd pick me up at 10 p.m. at night. And I was 8, 9 when I was doing this, 10. They wouldn't even come into the movies, you know, with their son, who was that young, and they would just, rather than spend the money, they would just pay for my ticket and leave me there.
Sam Esmail, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you.
Sam Esmail is the creator and the lead writer and director of the series Mr. Robot, which is in its fourth and final season on USA Network.